Tonight, we invite you to join us for WLRN's Cover to Cover, an hour-long program featuring authors reading from their latest work. Writers from around the country participate in this weekly program, focusing on the most talked about fiction and nonfiction being written today. Tonight, on Cover to Cover, we go to Key West, to the newly remodeled public library, and Jim Haskins, our guest speaker. Mr. Haskins teaches at University of Florida and travels between Florida and New York, where he makes his home. He's an Afro-American writer who's devoted his writing life to the black experience by concentrating on the lives of outstanding black Americans and developing books based on jazz and the dance experience in America. Introducing Mr. Haskins is Ross Claiborne, former editor at such publishing houses as Dell and Warner. He's on the board of the Key West Friends of Library, and he's also on the National Motion Picture Board. So now to Key West, Ross Claiborne, Jim Haskins, and the library.
Very distinguished program today, and it has dual or quadruple sponsorship. The lecture is called The Writing Life, and it is funded this particular occasion, by the Florida Center for the Book and the National Book Foundation, and is presented here by the Key West Literary Seminar and the Friends of the Library. How about that for credits? Our speaker here is Jim Haskins. He said to call him Jim. Who is a professor of English at University of Florida, Gainesville. He also lives and writes in New York City. He is the author of more than 100 books, so he will certainly be able to tell you about the writing life, both for the adult and the young adult market, and has won great recognition in both those areas, and I will give you a few of them. The Story of Stevie Wonder, a biography for young people, won the Coretta Scott King Award in 1976. His four-book Count Your Ways series won the Alabama Library Association Award for Best Work for Children in 1988. Scott Joplin, The Man Who Made Ragtime, won the ASCAP Deems Taylor Award for Excellence in Writing in the Field of Music, 1970. The Cotton Club, you may remember that movie, was inspired by a book by Mr. Haskins. Bricktop, which he wrote with the famous Paris singer Bricktop, was named a book across the sea by the English-speaking Union in 1983, and Black Music in America won the Carter G. Woodson Award in 1989, and lots of awards. In addition, Jim Haskins has written biographies of Bill Robinson, Ella Fitzgerald, Thurgood Marshall, autobiography with Lionel Hampton. Incidentally, there are brochures here of his books that are at the Key West bookstore, so you might want to take a look and see if you might not want to buy them. He has also written numerous articles and book reviews for the Gainesville Sun and many other publications. Welcome, Jim Haskins.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here to talk to you about the writing life. And one of the things I always say to people about this craft that we call writing is that if there's anything else you can do for a living other than be a writer, you ought to do it. The pay is not very well, but the life is interesting, and you lose a lot of things along the way, and you gain other things. You lose, for an example, your hair, and you gain gray where there used to be none. And sometimes you lose wives. That is not to say that there are people who don't lose wives and girlfriends and everything else, but I think being a writer and living with one is very difficult thing to do, because we tend to, for the most part, have conversations with ourselves, and you don't always know which voice is speaking, you or the person you're writing about. Now, I think that before you can talk about the writing life, I think you need to know something about the kinds of things that makes a writer. I never grew up or was born or wanted to be a writer. In fact, if my mother had had it her way, I would have been a doctor. In fact, before she passed, she used to call me the doctor who can't fix anything, meaning the PhD doesn't mean anything. You can't fix anything, you know. You don't have office hours, you know, you don't pull teeth. What do you do for a living, son? What makes a writer? I think the life. I like to tell people when they say, how do you do that much? And how did you come to be interested in those things and they're so diverse? I like to tell them that originally I was born in Alabama. I was born in Alabama, and originally at a time in the South when there were no books, for the most part, having anything at all to do with the lives of black people. And I always like to say I remember Alabama and I remember Florida when they were part of the South. Within the last 20 years, it's now the Southeast, and I don't know what that means, but to me, it's still the South. And I remember not being able to go into libraries. Libraries were segregated. A lot of people, a lot of my students at Florida don't remember a time ever in this country, and particularly in the South, when libraries were segregated. They have some vague memory of when schools were segregated, but they don't remember when libraries were segregated. And I remember that in my elementary school, segregated elementary school, there was something like about, I suppose, no more than 150 books to serve a very large population of students. And I had read them all. And in those books, I found nothing at all about me or about my people. Now, I don't want to make that sound too bad, because my mother had a friend, a white lady, who could use the library. And she used to check out books in the library and bring them to my mother for me to read. And by the time I suppose I had exhausted all of those books that I could read at that grade level, or at my reading level, my mother got into the habit of buying encyclopedias from Piggly Wiggly. I see some of you remember Piggly Wiggly. You spent $20 on grocery and you could get a volume of the encyclopedia. And so I proceeded to read the encyclopedias. By the time I was 15 years old, I had finished reading the encyclopedia from A to Z. And I used to read all the time, and my buddies used to ask me, Jim, what are you reading today? And I'd say, F. True story. I used to read everything, cornflakes, box of cornflakes, ingredients, license plates, everything. Ads and newspapers. So you begin to see that a life of writing begins first of all with a life of reading. And reading is an interesting kind of thing. And particularly encyclopedias, you discover that there's really only one volume. Everything sort of refers back to something else in another volume. and you began to hunger for more information and more knowledge. You know, you play word games, and you get into language. And then you get into questioning even the encyclopedia. You wonder why. You wonder why, even in encyclopedias, there's very little reference. And if there's any reference at all to anybody black, that they have negative connotations, particularly the volume A on Africa, and the volume N where an attempt was made to define Negro. It's what we would call in those days. My mother left Alabama and moved to Massachusetts, to Boston. I just want to, because she realized that the why questions of little Jim was going to get him in trouble in Alabama. You know, you start asking, well, why do we have to get off the sidewalk? Why can't we go into the library? Why can't I drink out of that fountain that says white? Children being naturally curious, if you were in a segregated city and you had any kind of thinking processes, you always wanted to know what was the difference in white water and colored water. And that could get you in trouble. And did get me in trouble. And so we left, in the words of Jack Teagarden, we left out of Alabama. Did you know that song, Stars Fell on Alabama? Well, we left out of Alabama before I would become an Emmett Till. And I'm glad to know that people here are old enough to remember Emmett Till as well. Most students I talk to says, Emmett who? They think I'm talking about Emmett Smith, who plays football at the University of Florida. Did something happen to Emmett? I said, no, Emmett's still alive and well and running ball for the Cowboys. I'm talking about Emmett Till. And I will remember the very first week of being in Boston. And my mother, in an attempt to teach me a lesson about the differences in Massachusetts and Alabama, left me on the front steps of the library on the Fenway. Being a little boy from Alabama, I didn't know what was going on. I sat outside. Not unlike a lot of other people sitting on outside the library. Looked around, sat there for an hour or so, and finally, one of the librarians who saw me sitting there came outside the door and said, little boy, what, are you lost? Are you waiting for someone? What, is there a problem? And I said, well, no, ma'am. I was waiting to see where the colored entrance was. The colored entrance to the library. I mean, I knew we had libraries in Massachusetts, but I thought there was a colored entrance. She says, little boy, where are you from? And I told her from Alabama. She grabbed me by the arm, nice Irish lady, says, come on in here, little boy, we don't do that up here. And then thus started my love of the library and got me a library card. And I sat there and I discovered a world of books, more books than I'd ever seen in my whole life. And I wanted to read them all. In fact, I sat down on the floor in the young adult room and they closed the library on me. I got locked up in the library my very first night of being in the day of being in the public library in Boston. And there I discovered, in that library, how very different libraries can be. Because in that library, there was, in fact, information and books about blacks. Discovered Crispus Attucks, Phyllis Wheatley, people I had never heard of in the school systems or in the library, from library books in Alabama. So I suppose that also began my understanding of the selection process, the separational process. And I decided somewhere even then, though I did not know it, that if there ever presented itself an opportunity that I could do something about it, that I would. And it took a long period of musing and thinking about doing something about it and getting in a position to be able to do something about it, you see, before you know that you are a writer. I didn't know that until after graduate school in New Mexico, and in an attempt to escape the Vietnam War, got a job teaching school in Harlem. And the very first book I wrote, which was not really a book at all, though I'm told that it is considered a good work, it's called Diary of a Harlem School Teacher, and it came out in 1965, 66. And that was simply a personal diary of my experiences of teaching inner city school in Harlem, because for the first time in my life, I never saw how students and children were being treated in ghetto schools. And I just had to write it down because I said to myself, when the war is over and I get out of this, I'm going to stop teaching, but I want to remember this because this is unreal. Now, I happen to have had a friend who was an editor at Grove Press who, in the process of looking for my real personal diary, if you know what I mean, a girlfriend, found that diary and said, this is a book. This is a book. I said, book? It's my diary. She said, oh, no. It's a book. And took it to Bonnie Rossett at Grove Press, who agreed. And that book came out, and it is still in print today. Still in print. It's gone through 10 or 15 printings because the problems in inner city schools still, in fact, obtain today. They have not changed. The children are still dying, as Jonathan Kozel would say. They're still dying. And the school systems still are not working for an overwhelming number of students in this country. Might as well be up south or down south. It doesn't make very much of a difference. And so from that book came the inquiries from other publishers who wanted me because of some of the things that I had said in that book, wondered if I could, in fact, write books. And I attempted to do so, you see, and started, and therein started the whole idea. And one book always somehow seems to lead to another. The first book after Diary of a Harlem School Teacher was, in fact, a book entitled Vietnam, the War and the Protest, because I wanted to have something to say about Vietnam. And the second book in that series, it became a series, was entitled Resistance, Profiles in Nonviolence, where I talked about William Sloan Coffin and the people who were against the war in Vietnam. And the third book, you see, born out of one book, became a book entitled Black Power. And from that book came another book entitled Revolutionaries, Agents of Change. So I tell people who are interested in doing this thing that it is not enough, not ever enough, to pick up a pencil and a piece of paper or a word processor or a typewriter, however it is you do this, unless you have something extremely urgent to say or important to say. Otherwise, you might as well just write letters home or use AT&T by reaching out and touching someone. We don't write letters anymore. And so, in a sense, I suppose I'm saying that from one book grows another book, and that book become part of a series or part of an ongoing interest, because, in fact, all of the issues are interwoven. All of the concerns, of the immediacy of what you have to say, whether it's about death poetry or romantic lyricism, it does not matter. The medium does not matter. Whether you're a reporter, investigative, or otherwise, the people who write the newspapers and spend the life of 250 and sometimes, if it's missionary, thousands of pages. It's a letter to you. It's a letter to you, the reader, about something that the writer feels it's extremely urgent to say and for you to know, whether or not it is a first 1A in your newspaper. The editors have determined that that is something extremely urgent and important for you to know. So, you see, Lionel Hampton, for an example, did not happen because I happen to know Hamp. It happened because of Bricktop. And Bricktop caused the Cotton Club to happen, you see. And Scott Joplin caused Bricktop to happen, you see. So while I may be interested in some kinds of political and educational things, I'm also, on the other hand, interested in music, because I think music is a very integral part of the American ethos. And to a greater extent, I'm interested more specifically in black contributions to that, to an area that we all love and enjoy, but what I consider to be undeservedly obscure as far as documentation was concerned. With the exception, of course, of Duke Ellington and Count Basie, you see. But I have had publishers, for an example, to say, well, why a book on Lionel Hampton? And I have to ask them, why another book on Frank Sinatra? When, in fact, there's no book at all on Hampton, then, except the one that I've done. Well, who's interested in Bricktop? Well, I said, well, I suppose the same people who are interested in the Duke and Duchess of Windsor and the same people who are interested in Liz Taylor and Richard Burton, because they all used to get drunk in her bar in Paris. And I said, well, for an example, did you know that F. Scott Fitzgerald still owes Bricktop some money? You see, he never paid her. And yeah, she used to throw Hemingway out of her joint. And then you hear editors say, oh, for some reason, the usage of those personalities give importance to Bricktop's life. It's not enough. You have to know about Elsa Maxwell. So that even in doing these kinds of books and documenting these kinds of people's lives, lives that I consider well-lived and worth knowing about and worth documenting. And that is why Bricktop also led to, for an example, a book on Mabel Mercer, still the one and only book on Mabel Mercer. So you don't get rich in this business doing the kinds of things that are important, doing the kinds of things that need to be done. You don't get your name always on the bestseller list. You do not make the kind of money of a Barbara Cartland or a Danielle Steele. But I also am happy to say that for the most part, you never see my books at book sales either. They are for the most part in the places that they ought to be. They're in the libraries. They're in the libraries. There for the children, and they're there for the people and the researchers and the writers who are going to come after me to have as a starting point. Because make no mistake, I don't consider very few of the things that I've written as being definitive. I mean, it's very easy to be definitive about someone's life who's dead. And if one's life is ongoing, then certainly there is no definitive study. So that one can't get off of a theme when one gets on it. One has to know when to say, stop, Jim. No more music books. No more music books. What are you going to do now, Jim? Well, I suppose I'll do some religion books. Always been interested in that. I want to know why people fight each other. I want to know why, when I teach Gulliver's Travels at the University of Florida, and Jonathan Swift was having the same problem with the British that they're having now in Northern Ireland. It's the same old story with a new twist. I want to know, really, and I always tell this story. Once when I was teaching at the New School for Social Research in New York City, teaching a course in basic problems in urban education, and a course in the psychology of language. And I got into this argument about a statement that I made, and I said, you know, the Arabs and the Jewish people are second cousins or first cousins, something like that, if I remember my Old Testament. What did I want to say that for? I had a riff in my classroom between the Christians and the Jews and the blacks and the Italians and everybody else who had a stake. And I said, what's this thing called Catholicism and Baptists and Methodists and Muslims and Arabs? And let me go take a look at that. It took me some 20 years later to do that, however, but I nevertheless did it to prove to the children that none of us are that much better, and nor are we that much worse than the other. It's the same thing with the Stevie Wonder and Duke Ellington. I mean, it's not a matter of whether or not Stevie Wonder is a better musician or whether the music is better or different. It's just different. The same is true of Wagner and Tchaikovsky. They're just doing something different. It's not better or worse than the other. But I say that to say that I asked my class, would you join me next Friday at the United Nations? Security Council was debating 22 years ago the Arab-Israeli question. And I will remember on the hall outside of the Security Council, the British ambassador and the American ambassador, who I think that time was Henry Cabot Lodge. The British ambassador, I don't know if it was what his name was, but they broke and they came, and I was standing there about 5 minutes from my class, and I heard the British ambassador say to Henry Cabot Lodge, I say, old boy, why can't the Jews and the Arabs settle their problems like nice Christian gentlemen? As you see, there's a problem. It's a problem. It just happened to have happened that moment in time, that someone else could say what I was attempting to say in that class even better than me. It's never going to be, because first of all, they're not Christians. You know that. So how can you resolve problems like nice Christian gentlemen? So someone needs, I said to myself, to explain. So how do I do this? And do this keeping in mind a black contribution to this mess. Well, it occurred to me that Ralph Bunche did, in fact, win the Nobel Prize, whether you believe it or not, was the first black American to win it, not Martin Luther King, but Ralph Bunche. And he wanted for the partition, settling the dispute for the partitioning for the State of Israel. And we have students who don't know that. We have adults who don't know that. I suppose Jesse Jackson has forgotten that as well. You see. But my Ralph Bunche is for the children, the young people. Now, of course, there's a new Ralph Bunche. All of a sudden, he's been discovered now by diplomatic and political writers. Big, huge 2,000-page volume on Ralph Bunche's life.